Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Hello, welcome to The Rest is History, the second part of our coverage of the World Cup of Gods 2021, which was running all last week on Twitter. In the first episode, if you listen to that, you'll know that we talked about the group matches. We discussed the gods that got knocked out. So that was Moloch, Chippy Totec, Ishtar, Bridget, Augustus Caesar, Loki, Kybele, and very sadly, Prince Philip. In today's episode, we're going to go through the quarterfinals, the semifinals, and then the final. And with me is my co-presenter, co-sports analyst, Dominic Sandbrook.
Saint and Greavesy of...
Saint and Greavy of World Cup, yeah. Divine sport. And so, Dominic, moving into the quarterfinals, we had Zeus against Athena, Mithras against Dionysus, Anubis against Isis, Apollo against Odin, talking points around all of them. Shall we focus in on the familial clash that was Zeus against Athena? So father and daughter. What was your take
on that? Yes. So I thought Athena was going to win that particular tie. And of course she did. She is born from Zeus's head. So as Jonathan Wilson said in his preview, she'd given him a headache in the past and she did so again. The funny thing is, you know, with Zeus, a lot of people said at the beginning, well, Zeus will win it because he's probably the most...
alpha male.
Yeah, it's the most famous, isn't he? He's the god that everybody knows. But I find Zeus quite boring.
Do you?
I do. There's not... He doesn't...
He's always plunging down.
Yes.
He's 150 affairs.
Yeah, exactly. He's his sort of modus operandi is he transforms himself into, you know, bull.
An animal.
Animal or something, and impregnates somebody, and then just goes back to Olympus again to face the wrath of Hera. But ultimately, that I find that quite a repetitive story. And he's not... To me, Zeus doesn't seem to have some of the weird complexity of some of the gods we discussed on the last podcast. So we talked about Kybele, for example, and nearly had a... strokes brought on by hysterics. But with Zeus, I mean, Zeus seems to be quite a humourless figure. Do you think that's fair, Tom?
I think
I'm being too harsh.
Turning yourself into a swan or a bull, or I mean, it's faintly sinister. I mean, it's
well,
a bit pervy.
In the age of Me Too,
it's boring.
In the age of Me Too, maybe Zeus would always
face... Zeus would be massively cancelled. But he'd also be cancelled as a kind of prime patriarch, because he's the model of an Indo-European sky god.
Yeah, an all-father, isn't he? I mean, he's
the all-father. But he's so his name, Zeus Pater, Sky Father.
Yeah.
You still get, you know, the full title in Jupiter, and you get it in Sanskrit too, apparently. So he knocks off the Pater bit, the father bit, just becomes Zeus. But he's absolutely the embodiment of this, the god of the sky who rules the universe.
Let's talk about Zeus and Jupiter a little bit. Because he's a good opportunity to talk about. People generally think of the Greek and Roman gods as identical, don't they? But is that wrong?
So Zeus is the classic example. Zeus and Jupiter, they basically have the same name. So they clearly reflect Indo-European traditions that have been brought to Greece and Italy, respectively. By and large, the Roman gods are less fleshed out than the Greek ones. Because the Greek ones are fleshed out by Homer, first of all, and then by the tragedians. Though, interestingly, Zeus is the only kind of major Greek god who doesn't appear on the tragic stage. So that's a kind of measure of his ultimate significance, that he can contain entirety in a way that the other gods can't. But on the Roman thing, the Roman gods, by and large, are less detailed. But when the Romans annex Greece, when they, and even before that, when they're annexing the Greek states in Italy, you know, Greece is the cultural trendsetter. And so inevitably the Romans kind of pair up their gods with the Greek gods. But, you know, right the way through into the imperial period, Jupiter has a role and a significance and a status that is distinctive within Rome that owes nothing really to Zeus.
And what is that then? What's that status that's different from Zeus?
Well, his temple on the Capitol is the most significant temple in Rome, and it's where the most significant annual ritual practices are taken place that help to maintain the spiritual health of Rome.
Yeah.
And that's incredibly important. So every year when the consuls are elected, they go up to the Capitol and the auguries are taken in front of Jupiter's temple. That has nothing to do with the stories that are told in Greece about Zeus, although obviously they're conflated.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Jupiter is properly boring in that, in the sense that you know, he is quite stiff.
And yes.
Where I don't think Zeus is boring. I mean, he's thunderbolts. He's the only guy who can handle thunderbolts.
Yeah.
So he's got weapons of mass destruction. He's sleeping around with everybody.
He's a bull. He's an eagle. He's an oak.
He's got all these children. I mean, so you know, Athena and Apollo, both contestants in this World Cup, are his children. And then he's got all the heroes, and he's got Helen. Helen of Troy is his daughter.
Is he almost too powerful though? Is he so powerful that makes him a little bit boring? Do you think?
Well, what happened? I mean, it's an interesting question that it could be argued that there is a kind of monotheistic trend within polytheism. That in a sense, it become what ultimately happens is that, and you see this in India as well, is that gods are simultaneously worshipped as individuals, but ultimately come to be seen as expressions of the one kind of expression of divinity. And in the Greek world, that can only be Zeus. He's the only god who can play that role.
Who can contain multitudes,
So I think he's clearly an alpha male, big player, but perhaps just not his
year. This is not, 21st century is not his time then, is it?
It's not
really
his time, is it? No.
All right.
Patriarchal harasser of women is, you know, never going to win.
The people assumed he was going to win, and for that reason he was never going to, because he was the kind of person who would have won in 1980 but wasn't going to win in 2021. So exit Zeus, and then we had, I thought, a very interesting clash, probably a bit more of a walkover than I was expecting. Mithras against Dionysus. Now Mithras, he's a fascinating god. I think
he's incredibly boring.
Well, this is very strange, because we completely disagree on this.
Why do you think he's interesting?
Because he's so mysterious, and also because he's sort of a bit of a Rotary Club character. I like that.
But
I like that aspect.
There speaks a man who's written histories of Britain in the 1970s.
Yeah, I see. It's a very 1970s god. He's a very 1970s god.
He is. You can imagine him in a sitcom.
Yeah.
Who's coming for supper? Ding dong. Oh, it's Mithras.
You know, in the Good Life.
Yes.
The people who live next door, Paul Eddington and Penelope Keith.
Dionysus.
They're definitely members of a Mithras sort of, aren't they?
Penelope Keith.
He's the god of civil servants, basically. If you're a low-ranking civil servant or an aspiring Roman officer, you go to... So let's explain what we mean for those people who think we've just gone mad. So Mithras, does he not come from Iran, from Persia?
It's generally assumed that he does, because there's a kind of a large number of a swirl of gods that sound a bit like Mithras. So there is an Indian god called Mitra, who's god of the skies. There's a Persian god called Mithra, who likewise ends up the god of the skies. And they essentially, a bit like Jupiter and Zeus, you know, again, these are Indo-European gods in Sanskrit and in Persian. They essentially, they're the same. And then what's the relationship of Mithras to that? Because if Mithra, the Persian god, and Mithras, the Roman god, are the same, then obviously his ultimate origins is Persia. I think that basically Mithras is a Roman invention.
Some historians think now, isn't it? There's a tenuous link with the East, but actually he's really a god for and created in Rome.
And the Romans have a deep prejudice against upstart cults. So that's why they're perfectly happy to tolerate, for instance, Jewish worship, because it's authentically ancient, even though the Romans see it as weird. But they regard Christianity as beyond the pale because it's of recent origin. So I think that the Mithras cult, it's astrologically centered. It's about the tracking of the heavens. But because the people who are developing it don't want it to look like it's an upstart cult, they essentially kind of identify it with Persia, which gives it a, you know, a sense that it's venerable and ancient, and
sense of a pattern of kind of authenticity. Yeah. And so basically the way it works is there are these places called Mithraeums, which are generally, I think, underground, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're sort of, you go to a Mithraeum And you generally tend to be invited to go if you're you've joined the Roman army, you're an officer in the Roman army, or you're a bureaucrat or something, and you're trying to make your way in the world. You get invited by a colleague, come to the Mithraeum on Friday night or whenever it is. I don't know when it is.
Put on a mask.
Yeah. You go to them and there's,
roll up a child's leg. It's that kind of stuff.
There's a sculpture often of a god killing a bull.
Yep.
That's always found there. There's also a sculpture that nobody's ever been able to explain of a man with a lion's head. People don't know where that fits in, but it does. And you go and you have a banquet and you sort of meet and greet, you know, middle managers and other, exactly. You know, coming men in the Rome. It's men only, like the Freemasons.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, there's an argument, isn't there, among historians that one reason why, you know, it's got a ceiling. It's got an inbuilt ceiling in terms of numbers because it's a cult for sort of middle class kind of, you know, aspiring bureaucratic kind of people.
And it has levels.
That means, yes, and there's gradations, there's initiation, there's sort of, and because of that, that means it's never going to become a mass market cult like Christianity, which is for the common man. Is that right?
Well, there's often this thing that it, you know, if the world hadn't become Christian, it would be Mithraic, but it wouldn't. For precisely reasons.
Because it was too much like the Rotary Club, basically.
Because it's too much like the Rotary Club, exactly. But it was very successful. So there's a Mithraeum that was found in London. That for a long time they kind of put it with crazy paving in the middle of the city.
Right.
And now it's beneath the new Bloomberg building. It's really good. Strongly recommend it.
And can you go and see it?
Yeah, you can. Yeah. Oh, nice. They've done it really well. And they've kind of, they use light to show. So you've got what does remain, the stones. And then they use light to show you what it might have looked like. And also there's a very atmospheric one on Hadrian's Wall.
And it's associated a lot with the army, isn't it? The Roman army.
Yeah, so that's why the one on Hadrian's Wall is there. But I think Mithras is boring.
I can't believe people haven't brought it back. I think it should come back. I think it sounds like a great... I mean, if there's a room for the Masons and the Rotary Club, I don't see why there isn't room for Mithras as well, for Mithraeums. Well, I mean, it just is a more exotic version of Masonry. Anyway, Mithras did crash out. He was beaten by Dionysus. So people clearly prefer wine drinking to bull killing.
Yes.
Which is sad.
Right. Now we come to probably this match was the huge talking point on Twitter, wasn't it? Anubis against ISIS.
So what we actually didn't mention last time was that Lockie had only lost by the slimmest of margins to Anubis.
Barest of margins.
I mean, he'd lost by like 3 votes or something because it was 50-50 in the percentages. But Anubis clearly had won, you know, a couple more votes. So Anubis had been through this incredibly exacting round against Lockie, and then he's up against ISIS. So another ancient Egyptian, goddess, a huge figure. And this was, again, a very tight... Anubis got an early lead, didn't he? And then thanks to your efforts, subverting the competition and corrupting the principles of the tournament, ISIS won a very narrow and controversial victory.
I just felt that it would be better for the sport to have the Queen of the Heavens in the semi-finals than a dog. I mean, you know, I've got
first of all, he's not
dogs.
A dog. He's not against... a dog. You clearly do have something against dogs because you're a cat person, as is well known.
He's not necessarily a jackal. Because jackals are golden and he's black.
No, he's a golden wolf. He's been reclassified, I think, as a wolf. As a sort of... so the jackal is not right. So I know a bit about Anubis because I made an Anubis costume, as listeners will know.
Give us Anubis then. Tell us why he should have won.
Well, he had a great name originally. He was Wep Wawet, which I think...
You can imagine the chants from the...
He's black.
The stands.
He's black.
Yes, like
so
a corpse.
The colour of death and also the colour of the soil, the fertile soil of the Nile.
Yep.
So he's linked to regeneration. Supposedly, I read that religious sort of historians believe that the Egyptians adopted him because wild dogs were digging up their corpses. So that it was obvious you'd need a dog-like protector to ward off the wild dogs. This is one theory anyway. He begins as the son of Ra, then he evolves into the son of Osiris in the way that Egyptian gods did evolve over the course of Egyptian history.
And Osiris, one of the great gods, married his sister Isis.
Yes, so he's up against Isis, obviously. And Anubis, basically, I'll tell you what he is, Tom. He's a psychopomp. A word that I didn't know until this morning existed.
A spiritual butler.
Yeah. He's present when you die. The psychopomp is the god who accompanies you to the underworld. He doesn't judge you. You know, give you a hard time. So it, what he is in a tradition that includes Hermes, St. Peter, and DCI Gene Hunt in Life on Mars and Ashes to Ashes. So Gene Hunt is Anubis. And I think that's another reason why Anubis should have won the entire tournament, because Gene Hunt's a great character for those people who've seen Life on Mars. And Anubis is basically the Egyptian Gene Hunt, because Gene Hunt, you know, welcomes 1970s British policemen into purgatory, doesn't he?
And then, I'm so impressed with your ability to get a discussion of 1970s policing into a podcast on ancient gods.
It's great.
So
anyway, all this is why Anubis is such an interesting figure. The sad thing about Anubis is there's no stories attached to him.
Well, there is, isn't there? In the kind of the more recent stories about him,
recent
3,000 years ago.
Yeah.
He is the child. So Osiris is married to Isis, and their sister Nephthys is married to Seth, who is the kind of, I suppose, the Loki. Really.
He's the baddie, isn't he? Yeah.
He's the baddie, who then kills Osiris. But Osiris, prior to this, has had sex with Nephthys, and Anubis is the result of this.
With his daughter, is that?
No, his sister.
Oh, his sister. Sorry, yes, I've got confused.
And Isis, no hard feelings about this.
Yeah,
you know, your brother husband has slept with your sister. Doesn't seem too fazed by this, and brings Anubis up. So she's his stepmother.
It's kind.
And then when Osiris gets killed by Seth, and we'll come to this when we talk about Isis, Anubis wraps him up and embalms him, and makes Osiris into the first mummy.
Yes, he's the god of mummification.
He's the god of embalmment. So he invents the mummy, basically. And I think that's the key story. But I agree. I mean, aside from that, I think he's not very interesting. Whereas Isis is a lot more interesting.
I think Anubis has an immense appeal to children because of his dog.
Yes, because of his dog head.
Dog head.
And also, he's appeared in loads of kind of films, hasn't he? And computer games.
Well, he's just become a sort of emblem of ancient Egypt.
Yes.
In a way that's probably not true of... I mean, how many Egyptian gods are fascinating, but how many of them do people remember? 3, 4? And Anubis is always one of them because of the canine appearance.
And Horus, I guess, is the other because he's got a head of a hawk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So my son made a Horus costume for his... When he was doing what I did when I was 5 or 6, he made a Horus costume. I made an Anubis. Did you ever make an Egyptian costume, Tom?
No, I didn't. I missed out on this rite of passage.
Yeah, missed out.
It's obviously a Midlands thing.
Must be. Yes. All right. So Anubis was defeated in very controversial circumstances. I think when we have future World Cups, there will clearly have to be a code of conduct about the judges or the organizers involved.
What I did for the benefit of the sport.
Well, that's Seb Blatter. I mean, that's what Seb Blatter says.
Fine.
It's what Florentino Perez says at Real Madrid. Super League.
The sport, c'est moi.
Yeah, clearly. All right. Let's do one more god before the break. And let's do Apollo. So
it's Apollo against Odin.
Yeah, Apollo against Odin. Now, Apollo to me...
And Odin won.
Quite comfortably.
Yeah,
I mean, surprisingly comfortably. Now, Apollo to me is the absolute epitome of a Greek god. I mean, he is the statue that seems to symbolize ancient Greece. And yet, what is it about him, I wonder? Is it a blandness, a perceived blandness that meant
he's not bland, though? I mean, he's terrifying.
Well, I don't think he's bland, but obviously people, the voters, didn't go for him.
I think Odin is a kind of very popular figure because he's got that kind of slight computer game edge to him.
Which Apollo doesn't really have.
Apollo doesn't. And I think also Apollo is kind of associated with a slightly chilly 18th century classicism.
Yeah, that's what I meant, I guess.
In the kind of the 18th century, the Apollo Belvedere was seen as being the most beautiful statue in the world, and nobody now rates it at all. But of course, actually, Apollo was a terrifying god.
So why terrifying? Why do you think?
Well,
terrifying?
He's the god of plague, for starters.
So, okay, that is terrifying.
You know, having gone through the past year, it's Apollo's plague arrows that have been raining down on us. You know, that's what the Iliad begins with is Apollo raining down plague arrows on the Greek camp. He's also he's the father of Asclepius, who's the god of healing. So again, you get that kind of weird tension
dualism that we
see again through, you know, in all these gods. And he's the god of prophecy.
Yeah.
But you know, we talked about this before. The way in, so he's one of his epithets is Loxias, which is kind of the oblique god. So anything he tells you is likely to trick you.
That's Lockyish element to him. No,
because I think it's not setting out to deceive you. It's factored in. It's kind of like a crossword puzzle.
Okay.
And the Greeks were puzzled by the people of who had other oracles. That when they got their oracles, they just took them, you know, they just took them straight. Whereas the Greeks knew that Apollo's comments, utterances, had to be read quite carefully. And if you didn't get them properly, then you'd probably come a cropper.
And this is the Oracle of Delphi. So does the Apollo cult begin at Delphi, or does Delphi just adopt him?
Well, there are two great cult centers. There's Delphi is one, and Delos is the other. And Delos is where Apollo and his twin sister, the equally terrifying Artemis, the virgin huntress, are born. And it's said that Delos was kind of floating around, and then it gets anchored when they're born. And the thing that's interesting about both Delos and Delphi is that they're effectively neutral. So that's something that you don't get with other Greek gods.
So it's not associated with a particular power, but a city-state.
Yeah. So both of those, they almost have a kind of missionary quality that's very, you know, exceptional in the Greek context. And it means that both Delphi and Delos become neutral spaces where people from different cities can meet up. But as you say, Apollo, I think for that reason, becomes the archetype of the Greek god, because he's with Zeus, he's kind of a properly universal one.
But then the weird thing is that he's, you know, the epitome of the Greek god, but in the Trojan War, in the Iliad, he's on the side of the Trojans, not the Greeks. Yeah. What's all that about?
Because the Trojans in the Iliad are seen as basically belonging to the same world as the Greeks.
Because they're part of the Greek world, and he just happens to be on their side rather than the Achaeans or whatever they're called.
Yeah. I mean, talking of the Trojan War, of course, there's a terrible warning there about picking gods and crowning one as the victor, because that's what basically starts the whole shebang.
Let's
hope that that doesn't.
One more question about Apollo.
Oh, yeah.
He has this habit of pursuing people who then turn into plants. Isn't that right? Hyacinth?
He does. Yes, he does. Well, so we had the peerless Jonathan Wilson providing sensational punditry. But we also had, in the semi-finals, we had commentary from Llewellyn Morgan, the great Ovidian scholar, whose short introduction to Ovid is really fantastic, highly recommended. And he makes the point in that a lot of what we think of as being Greek mythology is actually Ovidian mythology, because Ovid, the great Roman poet, takes these stories and packages them as a kind of single entity. And he's obsessed with people changing form. And he writes this whole poem about it.
Metamorphosis,
Yes, all the nymphs that Apollo is changing, and they're kind of turning into laurel trees or whatever. Yeah. That's absolutely a constant. But that's basically coming from Ovid, and from that it then passes into Ovid's huge influence on Shakespeare.
The Greek Apollo is he's not molesting all these people who become trees.
Well, he kind of is. I mean, there are these stories, but it gets packaged in a way that then gets taken out around the world by Ovid. So it's kind of like, you know, the Beatles absorbing all these various traditions and packaging them in a way that people can consume.
Okay. The Beatles have made their long expected appearance on a podcast about ancient gods.
Yes, and on that note, bingo card is filling up.
Yeah. On that note, we'll take a break and we will come back to discuss the four semi-finalists after the break.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. We've now reached the semi-final stage of the World Cup of Gods. There are four contenders left, and they are Dionysus, Isis, Athena, and Odin. So, Tom, let's do the two gods who would have ended up in the third, fourth place playoff, the bronze medal match that nobody ever wants to play in. And they are Dionysus, lost comfortably to Athena. Dionysus is a very interesting god, isn't he? So he's the son of Zeus and Persephone, is that right?
Semele.
I think there are different, are there not different, well, there are different accounts with all these gods, often of their origins. He's the god of wine, he's the god of theatre, and of course associated with the Dionysian mysteries and with the Bacchus cult in Rome. So again, is Bacchus and Dionysus, are they the same?
Yeah. Yeah, and the Bacchantes are people who follow Dionysus in kind of ecstatic rituals.
Yeah.
And is the theme of Euripides' great play, The Bacchae, which describes how Dionysus comes to Thebes and the king of Thebes tries to basically chase him off. So it's kind of like, the police trying to stop, you know, ravers having raves in fields. But Dionysus isn't having any of that. And he goes disguised as a woman. So Dionysus's followers, the maenads, are women who get possessed and incredibly violent and ecstatic. And so Pentheus, the king of Thebes, goes there disguised as a maenad. But he gets discovered and his own mother tears him to pieces. And that teaches him to try and stop.
Yeah, that would teach you a lesson.
Having a drunken orgy. So,
yeah. So in the public mind, Dionysus is the god of drunken orgies. Is there more to him than that, do you think?
Well, I don't know if you've read Roberto Colasso's Marriage of Cadmus and Harmony.
I have not.
A wonderful book about the Greek gods, very inimitable. My favourite sentence in that book is as follows. Dionysus's phallus is more hallucinogenic than coercive.
Okay. So talk me through that.
Well, he's a very erotic god.
Yeah.
The Sicyonians, we're told, worshipped him as lord of the female sex. So it's said that he's the one whose fingers can make it vibrate like the strings of a lyre. So that is one of his superpowers.
Yeah.
But the other superpower, obviously, is that he can bring his followers into a kind of ecstatic, altered state.
Yeah.
So you get sexual fulfillment, but you also kind of leave, you know, the diurnal tedium of your everyday life behind and enter this kind of ecstasy state.
But isn't there something, as the Euripides story suggests, something, there's a kind of a more sinister side to this? I mean, weren't people alarmed even at the time about that sort of Dionysian cult and the Dionysian
mysteries? The Romans certainly were. So the Romans ban it.
Yeah,
they regard it as sinister and dangerous. And obviously there's an element, you know, strong element of that in Euripides as well. But there's also a sense that Dionysus represents aspects of human character that it is folly to repress.
Right. So the id, he's pure id, basically.
Yeah, and that's what underpins Nietzsche's famous essay on the birth of tragedy, where he counterpoints Dionysus with Apollo as the kind of the yin and yang of Greek culture. Another very interesting aspect of Dionysus is that the story goes that he originally comes from India And he comes with a kind of great invasion force. Not soldiers, but, you know, girls in leopard skins and satyrs with vine leaves and things like that. But he brings elephants. And it was said that there was that lots of these elephants died on the battle on the island of Samos in the eastern Aegean. And what's interesting is that the skeletons of Pleistocene mastodons have been found there.
That's interesting.
And so Adrian Meyer, who's written a wonderful book about kind of classical paleontology,
yeah,
says that it's the first example that she can think of people correctly identifying a fossil as belonging to, you know, they identify these fossils as elephants and construct the myth around it. They're very interesting.
There's also an interesting story that when Alexander of Macedon goes east to India, the Macedonians find places where Dionysus is worshipped, and they think that Dionysus has climbed these rocks and
yeah,
all this sort of thing. So that there is clearly a sense in the Greek world that there is the Indian, that Dionysus has something to do with things that are going on further east. Isn't there also there are some Dionysus stories in which Dionysus is killed and reborn, and some scholars have said, well, this, you know, he's part of a kind of continuum with Osiris, who's also killed and reborn, and of course Jesus, who's the same story. Do you buy that?
Well, also, his mother gets incinerated because she gets tricked into asking Zeus to reveal himself in his full glory, and she gets kind of shriveled up, and Zeus rescues Dionysus, who's a little baby in the womb, and implants it in his own thigh. So that's another kind of weird thing.
Unusual. Do you know about Dionysus's association with Scotland?
No.
So in 1282, in Inverkeithing, the local vicar organised a Dionysian revel. Persuaded the women of the village to join him in a Dionysian rite or such.
And what happened?
A Christian mob killed him.
Right. Well, fair enough. I mean,
yeah,
I think you're asking for trouble if you...
13th century Scotland holding Dionysian revels. I think, it's a risk,
it's
isn't
cold
it?
Apart from anything else.
Yeah, I'd say so. So anyway, Dionysius, that wasn't enough. The Scottish vote wasn't enough to get him over the line. In fact, he lost very comfortably in the end. And so that was the end of him. And the other semi-final loser, to your great sorrow, I imagine, given your stated position, was Isis.
No, I was fine. I just wanted to see her get to the semis.
Isis is a very, very interesting god, isn't she?
She's a massive god.
She's a god who's part of this Egyptian kind of pantheon, as it were. Not they call it a pantheon. She's the wife of Osiris and the mother of Horus. But as time goes on, she becomes bigger and bigger. She becomes a sort of Apple computers or a Microsoft of gods. She's a startup that has just gone, become imperial. So that by the end of the sort of ancient Egypt, the Ptolemaic period, she is one of the Mediterranean's absolute, you know, she's the Coke or the Levi's. She's a colossal brand, isn't she?
She is. And she appears all over the Roman Empire. And there's a kind of ecstatic account in The Golden Ass by Apuleius, which is the only kind of surviving Roman novel in its entirety.
Yeah.
And this is this guy Lucius who gets turned into an ass. And that's what he does throughout the course of the novel. And then at the end, he prays to Isis, and she turns him back into his human shape. And he then goes on to become a massive devotee of the of Isis, and he shaves his head and is absolutely proud to go around bald.
Right.
And then at the end, he has another vision of Isis. And although we're not given the full details of this, because this is a secret that you can't reveal it, it's literally a mystery. Nevertheless, it's fascinating because it's one of the very, very, I think maybe even the only one really, that gives you a sense of kind of the ecstatic sense of identification that a worshipper of a god in, you know, the Roman period was capable of feeling. So it's a counterpoint to the sense of cults as being purely, you know, civic and transactional.
Yeah.
And I think that, the story that we get told about Isis, and the reason why Isis and Osiris and Anubis and Seth and all those guys kind of do have a cut through in a way that perhaps other Egyptian gods don't, is that it gets told by Plutarch, the Greek writer of the second century AD. And he basically gives it to us as the equivalent of a kind of, you know, Greek myth. And so he gives us this story about how Isis is married to Osiris. Osiris's brother Seth kills Osiris. Anubis then embalms him. Seth sends the coffin that he's been put into flowing down the Nile, ends up in Phoenicia. Demeter goes and sources it, rescues Osiris, brings him back to life fleetingly, has sex with him, gets him. Osiris gets her pregnant with Horus before going off to become Lord of the Underworld. Horus grows up and then kind of chases Seth away. And
yeah,
that's a story like we get in Greek mythology.
Well,
we don't get that kind of stuff otherwise in Egyptian mythology, which is why I think it has less resonance with people than, say, Greek myths.
You made a slip there, which I thought was really revealing, which is why I didn't correct it, because it's really interesting. You called her Demeter. Isis and Demeter have been identified as similar, haven't they? I mean, they play a similar part.
Well, so what happens when Isis goes to get source the tomb of Osiris is that she pretends to be a nursemaid for the prince of where is it? I think it's Byblos or Tyre, one of them.
Right.
And she wants to give the son of the prince of Tyre immortality. And so she prepares him and is going to put him in the fire. She's surprised doing this. So she has to reveal who she is. And a very similar story is told of Demeter at the time when she's roaming the world looking for her daughter Persephone, who's been abducted by Hades, the god of the dead, and taken.
So do you think the Demeter cult is basically the Greeks? Because the Isis cult is obviously older. Have the Greeks, probably through merchants or whatever, picked up the Isis cult? And do you think?
Very difficult to know. And the Greeks themselves weren't sure. So there are lots of theories about that. The relationship of the Greek gods to the Egyptian gods. So Herodotus, who's the first person really to write about Egyptian gods, absolutely clear that the Egyptian gods come first and the Greek gods are kind of pale echoes of the Egyptian gods. Whereas for us, it's often the other way around. The Greek gods are much more vivid in our imaginings.
But that's because of their sources. It's not because they're
So I don't know is the answer. It may be there's a kind of direct influence, but I think also it's the fact that people in antiquity are prone to accepting that everyone essentially is worshipping the same kind of gods. It's just that they manifest themselves in different ways.
They're more ecumenical, weirdly, than we are. Yeah.
Yeah. And so therefore, if you're a Greek going to Egypt, you're going to identify, say, Amun or Ra with Zeus. You're going to identify Isis with Demeter, rather like the Romans do as well.
Well, then there's this period, isn't there, Tom, which is fascinating, which we haven't massively talked about, of pure sort of syncretism, when the Greeks are running Egypt. So when the Ptolemaic family, these Macedonian Greeks are running Egypt, and then they actually go out of their way politically to identify, Greek gods and Egyptian gods, because it obviously suits them. It suits their sort of empire building project.
And they invent one, Serapis.
Yes.
Who we were thinking perhaps should have been included, but wasn't. But I mean, he's completely, completely made up kind of fusion of Greek and Egyptian elements.
But that raises a really interesting question, doesn't it? That again, a bit like we were talking about Augustus on the last podcast and about how including him sort of it changes the way you think about the division between mortal and immortal, the sort of slightly simplistic way that we might think of it today. I mean, clearly they don't think there's anything wrong with inventing a god.
I think we bring and I've said this before, and I'm sure I'll say it again, but we bring a Christian perspective, and we find it very difficult.
I never would have imagined you would say that.
The very idea of kind of gathering all these together as pagan gods is a Christian perspective, and in the last podcast we talked about how the way in which gods become dead. Christianity is like a kind of radiation leak, killing them off.
Yeah,
and Islam, and. We see them through that prism, I think.
And one last thing about Isis. So Isis is very political because Cleopatra VII, the famous Cleopatra, she takes the title the new Isis and she dresses up as Isis. And this is all part of proclaiming her legitimacy, but it's also linking herself to this incredibly successful cult. And Octavian, Augustus, who we talked about in the last podcast, he tries to sort of keep this out of
Rome. He casts himself as Apollo.
Does he? I didn't know that.
Yeah, so Antony had identified himself with Dionysus.
Yes.
Octavian identifies himself with Apollo and Cleopatra is going the full Isis.
But then when he wins, he says, let's not have any Isis temples in Rome. and the Senate is very hostile to the ISIS cult. Is that because it's seen as too Egyptian? It's sort of, sort of orientalizing. And
yeah, but it comes. It's there. I mean, by the end of so by 69 AD, the year of the four emperors after Nero, there are priests of ISIS everywhere, and they get embroiled in a kind of punch up that ends up with the incineration of the Temple of Jupiter on the Capitol. So they're absolutely a part of it. And actually, the worship of ISIS carries on into the reign of Justinian, the great Christian emperor of the 6th century who builds Hagia Sophia in Constantinople. There's a temple to ISIS at Philae, which is kind of, you know, right the bottom of the south of Egypt, an island in the Nile, that's only closed then. So she goes on a very, very long way.
Very long time. And what do you think of this argument among some comparative sort of scholars that the relationship between ISIS and Horus is sort of paving the way for the relationship between Mary and Jesus?
I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure that there's, if you're having statues of ISIS suckling Horus, it's not a great leap then to, it's not that Christians are kind of stealing it. It's just that it's the kind of the emotional fulfillment that you get, I guess, from identifying with Mary has been prefigured by the emotional identification that generations of people have had from looking at ISIS.
Yeah. And the sort of the idea, I suppose, is just there in the ether, isn't it, of the mother and child. I mean, it's just part of the cultural conversation. Okay, so ISIS, I mean, there was a similar margin in the two semifinals. ISIS also got knocked out. I think, frankly, she did well to make the semis. She's very interesting. She's an interesting god, though. She's a very, I don't begrudge her place in the last four. I think she's a, and I think it was great actually to have somebody who, from out of the sort of the traditional sort of superpowers of Greece and the Norse world, and somebody who, you know, worshipped across the Mediterranean and stuff. So let's get to the final. Athena versus Odin. I think Athena was our number one seed, so we clearly always saw this coming. Odin, I think, I can't remember what he was seeded about five or six, wasn't he? Who should we do first? Let's do Odin.
Let's do Odin first.
He was the runner-up. Yeah. So Odin was beaten. It was a very tight result.
Exciting match.
52-48. Athena got off to an early lead. Odin ate into it not by enough. We can.
And it was 48-52. So
yeah, I mean, very Romain leave. But the roles reversed because I think Odin had a bit of a lever kind of.
Yeah, he's definitely.
He's sort of. You know, he's all about plucking out his eye and sort of...
Which they're all doing. Well, he's Sunderland very, and the Brexit heartland.
Well, he's very sort of... He's very red meat, isn't he, Odin?
He certainly is, yeah.
He's Woden or Wotan. Tacitus. Didn't Tacitus equate him with Mercury, which seems very odd?
Yeah, I mean, they're all over the place. I mean, so in his form as Woden, of course, he's given his name to Wednesday.
Yeah, and Wensfield,
and he's the ancestor of the Queen.
West Midlands. And the ancestor of the Queen?
Yeah.
Who is descended from Woden then among the Queen's ancestors?
The House of Wessex.
Is it?
So the Queen's, you know, trace her ancestry back to Alfred, and Alfred can trace his ancestry back to Cerdic, who's the first of the West Saxon kings, supposedly.
Yeah.
And he can trace his ancestry all the way back to Woden.
So Prince Philip, who got knocked out in the first round, he did have family connections in the tournament, which is nice.
Well, he married the descendant of a goddess.
Yeah, that's good.
And that's one of the reasons why I'd be sad personally to see the monarchy go, is because I love the idea of being ruled by, you know, having a head of state who's descended from a god.
Yeah. So not
French
just
haven't
a
god's, got that, have they?
A god's vicegerent on earth, but the representative of the descendants of another god.
So yeah. Macron calls himself Jupiter.
Does he?
But we know that he's
does
immortal.
He? Yeah, he does. Does Macron call himself Jupiter?
Yeah, he does.
How do we know that?
It's all over the place.
Oh my word. French.
But we have, you know, our head of state is descended from a god. But yeah. Woden is quite boring because we don't really know anything about him.
So
whereas
hold on.
Odin and Woden, it's the same thing. But Odin is the Viking name for him.
Yeah. And he's eye plucking out to make himself
so
wiser.
Great.
Yeah. He wounds himself with a spear. It's very sort of fisher king.
He hangs himself from a tree.
Yggdrasil. Is it Yggdrasil?
Yeah, probably. Well, it's a rootless tree. And so people assume it is, and he hangs himself there for 9 days, nine nights, and this wins him wisdom.
Right. Yes.
And the other way he gets wisdom, yes. So the eye plucking.
Yeah.
So the well of Mimir. and he plucks out his eye and then is able to drink from the water. So he absorbs this all this wisdom. And then Mimir, who's a kind of giant spirit kind of guy, he dies. And so Odin chops his head off and carries it around with him and consults the head of Mimir whenever he needs something. So it's a bit like an iPhone, I guess. it's a kind of...
Oh, you're always looking at your head.
A Norse iPhone, yes. Yeah.
And well, so that's pretty gory. And the sort of the image that in the popular imagination is that the Greek gods are all about kind of strumming lyres and drinking wine and sort of admiring grapes.
Well, Odin, there's a brilliant line. On wine alone does weapon glorious Odin live.
On wine alone?
So that's
quite surprising. So he's not all about mead halls and beer.
I think he had that as well.
There's a more sophisticated side to him that we don't often see. But this is my question. In the public imagination, the life of the Vikings, or the life of the northern peoples before the coming of Christianity was very nasty, brutish and short. It's always raining and they're always killing each other. And that therefore their gods are similarly violent and their mythological world is similarly bleak in contrast to the more sort of louche ways of the Mediterranean gods. Do you think that's true, or was that just a sort of silly stereotype?
Well, the classical gods are pretty terrifying. As I'm sure we'll talk about when we come to Athena. I mean, they kill a lot of people. I mean, basically, they start the Trojan War just because they're bored.
Yeah.
There's a lot of death. Odin is a very... yes, I mean, I think he's the lord of the Valkyries who... You know, there's kind of terrifying descriptions of them stretching out intestines across battlefields as though they're the threads on a loom. I mean, kind of terrifying images. And Odin himself, one of the other ways in which he gets wisdom is to sit under people who've been hanged. So he clearly absorbs wisdom from the experience of human suffering. And you've just got to look at the list of names. So there's a fabulous book by Neil Price. I think it's called The Viking Way.
Yes. That's the predecessor to his Children of Ashnell.
It's really brilliant. Really, really brilliant. I read it as a PDF before it had been properly published. And it was kind of like a Samizdat work that people were handing around. And his argument is that this is all about kind of shamanism, that you have to get into a heightened state. And Odin, he lists all the names that Odin has been given in all the various epics and the runes and whatever. And there are over 200. So I noted down some of them. You've got Father of the Slain, Lord of Treachery, Screamer, the Hooded One, Battle Wolf, Evil Worker, Lord of the Dead, Hangjaw, Nourisher of Carrion Eaters, Lord of the Hanged.
Wow. I'd like some of them on my tombstone.
And that's not somebody you want to mess with.
No, that's very impressive. But he's got pets, hasn't he? Well, he's got ravens. He's got, what else has he got?
He's got two ravens who are both called Thord.
Yeah.
He's got his eight-legged horse Sleipnir, and he's got two wolves, Freki, and brilliantly, Jerry.
Jerry. If I had a wolf, I'd call him Jerry, I think.
Actually, I think it's Gary, but it's funnier if it's Jerry.
But he comes to a... I mean, none of that avails him much because he's eaten by a wolf himself.
Yeah, Fenrir.
Isn't he? Fenrir, yeah. So he comes to...
The son of Loki.
This is, again, quite unusual in the Norse cosmology, isn't it? Because we don't have a sense of how the Greek sort of cosmos will end. But we do have that with the Norse gods. A sense of apocalypse, looming apocalypse. I mean, there's no sense that for Apollo, it's all going to turn horribly nasty one day and it'll come to a hideous end. Whereas for all the Norse gods, we know precisely what's going to happen to them, and it's never very pleasant.
And you'd assume that that's an authentic tradition. I mean, the complication is that the account of Ragnarok, you know, the end of the gods, Götterdämmerung,
comes much later,
is written by a Christian writer. And so... to what extent has this been mediated through Christian takes on the apocalypse and the end of the world? And we don't know. But Odin does, you know, like so many gods, fades before the coming of Christianity. But there is in Iceland, there are kind of charm formulas that continue to mention Odin right the way into the early modern period. And even in Sweden, there are kind of folk memories of him, not as a god, but as someone who, I think, you know, if he appears, he will bring you wealth. He's a kind of devil, demon.
Yeah.
So he kind of leaves trace elements there.
There's all the stuff about him leading the wild hunt as well, isn't there? Particularly,
well, that's kind of more, yes,
Germany.
Perhaps, but hugely contested.
Right. So it may not be the same thing.
Yeah. Well,
may not be the same Odin.
Yeah. So Odin essentially then gets reinvented in the 19th century.
Yeah.
And of course gets adopted by the Nazis. So he's very popular with neo-Nazis. I think the guy who wore the bison head who broke into the Capitol.
He's done the Viking gods no favours. Yeah.
No, he hasn't. I think he had all kinds of Odin tattoos and stuff.
Did he? He's the man who had, when he was imprisoned in Arizona or New Mexico or wherever it was, his mother made a great fuss and said he had to have vegan food. Do you see that? Organic food.
Right. Okay. Well, Odin wouldn't go any trot with that.
No, he wouldn't. Well, anyway, Odin put up a very, very strong showing. He got 48% of the vote, but it wasn't enough because he was up against the number one seed, Mary Beard's choice before the tournament, Athena. Athena won. I was a bit disappointed, Tom, if I can.
Why were you disappointed? I wanted Athena to win.
Did you? I didn't.
She's my patron goddess.
I didn't want Athena to win. I was a bit disappointed because I thought she was a bit of an obvious choice. You will be horrified by this. Because you're going to now tell me this is completely complete misreading. I find Athena a bit colourless.
I am horrified.
Yeah, to me, she's just a bit too mainstream. She's. I like a niche god.
I like kind of music.
She's the Coldplay. She's Coldplay.
Yeah, she's. You liked her before she.
Before she was, I saw her when she was nothing.
Before she became famous.
Yeah, I saw her at the Civic Hall in Northampton.
She's the embodied. I mean, she's again a bit like Ishtar. She's fuses warfare with the arts of civilization.
So she's wisdom and war
and war.
And is it right? Am I right in thinking she takes her name from Athens rather than the other way around?
Probably.
She began as the civic goddess of Athens.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. We don't know. But yes, so she gives her name to Athens. She's the patron of Athens. Her name is the same as Athens. And she is the presiding genius of the golden age of the democracy. And actually, it's impossible to understand the significance of democracy without understanding the relationship that the Athenians had with Athena.
Why?
Because,
what's she got to do with it?
So what you'll hear about Athenian democracy, and it's always said, is it wasn't real democracy because only men, free men had the vote. What about the women? And what about the slaves? The thing is that Athena is the guarantor of the relationship that the Athenians have with their past and with their future. And the demos, the power that's vested in the demos. The demos is the totality of every Athenian that's lived and will live. And you have to have been born on the soil of Attica because that's sacred to Athena. So you can't be an Athenian if you're born elsewhere. You were literally born from the soil, you're autochthonous. And therefore it's as important to keep Athena on board as it is to sit in the assembly and draw up laws. So the role of men is to sit in the assembly and draw up laws. The role of women basically is to keep Athena happy. And for the Athenians, that's just as significant.
So female listeners who will say, well, that just sounds like typical men making up a reason to keep women sort of in their place. You'd say that's not true at all. That's actually...
That's a very 21st century perspective.
Yeah.
And it's a perspective, again, that ultimately comes from Christianity that says that every human being is of equal value and equal right. That's not how the Greeks saw it. The Greeks saw it in a very, very different way. So when we think of democracy as a kind of abstract principle that everyone should have a vote because everybody has an equal value. And that therefore, if you're saying that women can't have the vote, then you're saying that women are less valuable, that their opinions are less valuable, that their rights are less significant. For the Athenians, it's about keeping the demos on the road, and you do what you do to ensure that happens. So the men draw up the laws and they go off and fight to defend the demos. And the women have this relationship with Athena, and they do the necessary rituals that will keep Athena on board, which likewise is just as important. But it's, so you've got to kind of put yourself into the shoes of someone for whom Athena is a powerful, terrifying, but ultimately wooable figure.
Why terrifying, Tom? Why, well, you've said that a few times.
She kills a lot of people.
Okay.
I mean, the classic one is that anyone basically who calls her out, she kills or turns into spiders. So Arachne, the maiden who claims that she's better at weaving than Athena, and Athena zaps her into a spider. And she's merciless to those who offend her equally. And this is why I think she's a great god, and why I think that she corresponds to something kind of fundamental in the nature of the way that life is. You know, she has people she hates and she has her favorites. And that seems true to life.
Yeah.
There are people who have a kind of golden existence. And of course, her most famous favorite is Odysseus.
Yes, because she's cropped up again and again, doesn't she, in the Odyssey and also in the Iliad.
She's very, very close to her protégés in a way that other gods aren't. Other gods are kind of more distant. But yeah. Athena is always at their ear, kind of whispering in them. There's a wonderful collection of short stories about the Odyssey called The Lost Books of the Odyssey by Zachary Mason. And there's a great story in that where Athena is secretly in love with Odysseus. And she tells Odysseus that she's in love with him, and Odysseus laughs. And she then vanishes. She goes bright red and vanishes. Very affecting.
Oh, nice.
Highly recommended.
She's a virgin. Isn't she?
She's a virgin, yes.
And so do you think there's a link? We've talked a few times about links with Christianity or with subsequent religions. Is there a link with the Virgin Mary, do you think?
Well, her shrine, the most famous shrine, Temple Parthenos, Parthenon, the Virgin, the kind of the Virgin's Temple, becomes the church dedicated to the Virgin in the Christian period. And what's also interesting is that Athena guards the walls of Athens. So when Athens is attacked, she can be seen walking the walls, patrolling it.
I know what you're going to say, Constantinople.
So in Constantinople, the Virgin is seen
protecting
Constantinople when the city is under siege. And that's a tradition that then passes into the folklore that's told about the defense of Moscow in the Second World War, because it's said that Stalin sends up an icon of the Virgin in a plane that flies around the city limits of Moscow. So there's these kind of strange inheritances that pass down through the centuries. So I think Athena's a wonderful god and a worthy winner, and I'm very happy that she.
You're with Sigmund Freud on that, because didn't Sigmund Freud have a sculpture of Athena on his desk?
Probably. I certainly have.
You're very similar people in many ways. Anyway.
wonderful note on which to end.
So that concluded the World Cup of Gods. Athena was the champion. Tom, what have you learned from this? This process, as Alan Sugar would call it,
that gods are very weird, and that we tend to have a very one-track sense of what gods should be. That the diversity of belief over the course of the centuries and across the span of the globe undermines.
Yeah, I mean, you think there's lots of continuities, but people don't dress up in other people's inverted skins.
No.
Anymore, do they? As they were Chibitotec. No. I mean, I still think it's a tragedy that Prince Philip didn't win. Would have been very good for Britain, good for the Queen. Nice in the tough time, but it wasn't to be. Clearly, the public thought otherwise, and the voters, I suppose, are never wrong. So Athena was the champion, and we'll have to do another World Cup in a few months, Tom. Got any ideas?
I think Kings and Queens of Britain.
I think it would be brilliant. Brilliant.
Maybe American presidents.
Okay. Jolly good.
Lots to look forward to.
We shall. We've got some great episodes coming up. We've got Magna Carta coming up. We've got Mohammed,
which is topical because he was a great toppler of idols. So
yes,
in a way, a kind of perfect follow up to this.
See you next time. Bye bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to The Rest Is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.